Let's do it.
To the right, 5 seconds to go in the first half. Dante fires deep to the left. Moss caught it at the 11, but now he pitches
look at
it.
This.
Demole Williams, touchdown!
You gotta be kidding me!
Welcome back to another episode of the Climbing the Bucket Podcast. I am your host, Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason. And, guess we're not joined by the full crew this evening. Got my man QB1 here. Well, what's going on, man?
What's going on?
And we got Saxy Prince with us, but he is at a Vikings event right now at the stadium. So we can see the roof of the stadium, but Saxy Prince has us on mute. And when he's not, you know, out there smoozing with the big dogs, he is going to pop in, give us some commentary, and drop back out. Miles is not with us. He is out hanging out with his wife and another couple, having a dinner date, loving life, small talking with the other husband, enjoying himself. So he will not be on today. So, JR, man, what's going on? What's on your mind? What's out there that you wanted to talk about before we hop into all this Vikings talk we got tonight?
So you guys kind of called me out about this whole J. Cole situation. You know, being a fellow North Carolinian, I just wanted to say I like J. Cole. You know, I like his music. Friday Night Lights was great. Every other album that he released was great. I just can't listen to him for a long time because I get bored and he puts me to sleep. I'm just not a storytelling rap guy.
Okay, so like when you're going in for rap, what are you looking for? Are you more just kind of going in for the groove, listening to the hook, the beat? Or are you like, you know, you backpack rapping, listen to the conscious stuff? Like what gets you going?
Just give me a good beat and a good hook on repeat, and I'm fine with that. That's my type of music.
I feel like, and I know I'm stereotyping, I guess kind of my own people in saying this, but I feel like that's such a Southern response.
I mean, that's just what we like. You know, Migos, things of that nature. That's what we like, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, music you can dance to.
Right.
Yeah, ain't nothing wrong with that. Ain't nothing wrong with that. And I know we had a pretty spirited debate in here. What's your favorite Denzel movie, man?
You know, Training Day is the obvious one that most people say or Remember the Titans. But me personally, I'm a big fan of John Q. That is just like my ultimate movie. There isn't a lot of movies that just has you on the edge of your seat and almost in tears. But John Q does that to you. I just didn't think The Heart was going to get there in time. You know, it's just an underrated movie and I love it. It's probably one of my favorite Denzel Washington movies.
Okay. For me, it's Man on Fire. And I'm not going to say that's Denzel's best movie, but that's the Denzel movie that if it's on TV, I'm pretty much going to watch it whenever just because, yeah, it's fun watching Denzel go around, just be badass, blow things up. Yeah, wish you had more time. Like that line was just so cold. So anytime that's on, got to do it.
Absolutely. I don't have no problem with that choice.
All right. And I guess, you know, we've got our daily arguments from the group message out into the public now. But there was one other thing that's kind of circulating. And I just saw a follow-up story on this, I guess, controversy. I mean, that's what it is. A controversy that was going on in the sports world, world of politics yesterday, where, Jemele Hill in a back and forth with somebody on Twitter called Donald Trump a white supremacist, said that many of the people that were around him were white supremacists. Obviously that, you know, made some folks upset. And then, you know, the press secretary basically said it was a fireable offense. I guess, what are your thoughts on all that? Because you normally stay out of politics, but politics kind of came to your sports yesterday. What were your thoughts on all that stuff?
It did. And, you know, I'm not a big politics guy. I don't pay a lot of attention to it because it's just a never-ending debate. But I don't know. I think it's kind of an overblown issue because we always talk about freedom of speech. And, you know, she was saying exactly how she felt. Trump has said or tweeted out similar things in the past, even if it was years ago. He has, you know, openly criticized the president, who was Obama at the time. And the whole thing about the whole situation is I just don't want it to be a double standard, considering that our president has said, you know, previous or similar things in the past about the president. But she was just saying, and she still has her right to freedom of speech. And I think a lot of people are trying to incorporate her company into it and just saying that, you know, she represents ESPN. She talks on ESPN. She has her show on the 6 p.m. Sports Center. And kind of thinking that deters her from saying exactly how she feels about something. That's the issue I had with it. She still has her freedom of speech. And I don't think she should have apologized for it or should have had to apologize for it, because that is her right to say what she wants. But, you know, it comes back to, oh, she represents the ESPN. She works for ESPN. I don't think that should have anything to do with it as far as her freedom of speech.
Yeah, I feel you on that. But at the end of the day, I guess we all work for somebody. And the man who cuts the check said you need to go out there and say a little something. Yeah, most of us can at least say a little something. But at the end of the day, her public apology, I don't know if I'd even call it that. I mean, she addressed the elephant in the room. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I think Gab said it. I mean, she pretty much her apology was, I said what I said. And I'm sorry my company got dragged into all this. But, yeah, I said what I said. And I'm sorry to my coworkers that, you know, I did all these. I brought this attention to them. So, you know, I think, like you said, it's a bit overblown. People seem very, very touchy on both sides of a lot of these issues for everyone. Everyone just wants to debate endlessly, it seems, online. But this is one of those things where, like, you know, politics, sports, they came together. And I know you had an opinion, so I wanted to talk about it on the show today. So I guess with that, you know, said and that aside, let's hop into some of this Vikings talk. So right after the game, you know, top of mind, looking at the TV broadcast, we jumped in there. We talked about kind of what we felt, what we saw, just watching the game, you know, one time. Obviously, you know, knowing you and, you know, seeing the stuff that you've done on Twitter, some of the stuff that's been on the climbingthepocket.com site, you obviously have to go back and look at things a little bit more closely and get into that tape and really look and analyze what's going on. So now that you've had a chance to go and do a secondary review of things, what were your thoughts on the game?
Well, I'll start on the offensive side of the ball. I thought Sam Bradford played an outstanding game. I think it was the best game he's ever played in his career. And I'm not saying that. I'm not exaggerating that. I think it's the best game Sam Bradford has played since he was drafted into the NFL. You know, that's how good he played. And what we saw was he finally felt comfortable behind the offensive line. And that's the first time in his career that he's completely felt secured behind the offensive line. And the biggest question we had about Sam Bradford was, you know, how will he react when he is protected? And we saw that on Monday. You know, they gave him plenty of time to throw. I believe he was only sacked one time. But he was throwing darts left and right. It wasn't just quick screens or, you know, those quick hitches or slant routes or those quick developing routes. He was taking shots down the field. He was taking his one-on-one matchups when he had them. And that's the thing that we wanted to see with Sam Bradford. So I thought he played really well. Another guy who I thought did really well was Pat Shurmur. And, you know, me and you have had plenty of questions about him, but I thought his game plan was really good. He seemed to just be a step ahead of everything that the Saints were doing defensively. I was shocked that they came out and played so much man-to-man coverage, considering, you know, they have such a young secondary. You know, they have the first-round pick in Marshawn Lattimore, who this was his NFL debut going against Diggs and Thielen, and they ate him alive in man coverage. So I was really shocked to see them play so much man-to-man coverage. And what Shurmur was doing, he was incorporating those rub routes and those crossing routes, you know, to get Diggs and Thielen in space over the middle on those linebackers and safeties, and just creating confusion by so much, you know, crossing and rub routes and things of that nature. Transition over to the defensive side of the ball, I thought those guys played really well. And the one thing I thought that was really good above the rest was the red zone efficiency. Holding those guys out of the end zone three straight times was really good, especially on that first drive. That was 10 plays, I believe it was. It ate up 7 to 8 minutes on the clock. And just to see them end up with a field goal on that first drive, I thought was really huge. So those were some really good spotlights, I thought, from the game on Monday.
Yeah, man. And you mentioned, you know, Sam, obviously he played lights out. I agree, probably best game of his career. Shurmur, like, he's the guy that I had the most doubt about. I've said on Twitter many, many, many times, he was the factor that I was most concerned about. Sam's talent has always been obvious. Sam can throw the ball all over the field. But Pat Shurmur, in terms of kind of his talent as an offensive coordinator, when you look back over his record, last year's offense was the best offense that he coordinated, which isn't really, you know, it's not a badge of honor. I think we were 21st overall. But when I look at this game, the things that really jumped out at me when you start to go and look at the stats is that Sam increased his average depth of target by almost a full yard from his, you know, 2016 average. So if that can continue throughout the whole season, I mean, that's huge from last year where he was last in the league in ADOT and basically, you know, checking down short passes on everything, you know, increasing that by almost a yard in the first game is huge. And then really the next thing where it kind of goes along with that ADOT is that we were worried about Sam on third downs, you know, and those check downs. And in the beginning of the game, you know, we saw a couple and people started to grumble and Twitter started to get anxious. But by the end of things, if you look at the NFL's next gen stats, Sam went from, you know, dead last in the league last year in terms of aggressiveness on third down to ninth. So top 10 from, you know, a top 10 finished in the first game after finishing dead last year. You know, I will take that all day, every day. And then from an offensive perspective, you mentioned the red zone on defense. You know, I thought that they did a great job in the red zone. We passed it. So last year, our ratio in the red zone, I think, as everyone can remember, we stubbornly ran the ball probably more than we should have when we got down there. But this year, and obviously it's just one game, but, you know, in that one game, our pass rate was up to 60%. The one thing that we were a little bit down on, which was a bit surprising, our rush success rate was a little bit worse than it was, you know, last year. But it's obviously just one game. And then really the last thing, again, really the last, I guess, feather in the cap for Pat Shurmur is that the play calling was so much more unpredictable than what we've seen or what we've been accustomed to as Vikings fans over the past few seasons, where, you know, we pretty much all could, you know, we'd watch the formation and we'd know it was going to be a run up the gut or whatever it was going to be on first down. But when you look at first downs here, it was almost an even split, 30 runs, 33 passes on first downs in this game. And that's, I mean, just kept the defense on its heels the entire game. Sam executed, you know, Diggs was lights out. Thielen was amazing. They really only targeted Rudolph in the red zone, which is probably the best place to use him. Like, all around, it was a masterful game on offense. And then the defense did what they needed to do to slow down Drew Brees and company. So, yeah, great game, great first start. I'm excited about what it means for the rest of the season. But, you know, it is a grain of salt. The Saints are the Saints. Their defense, I can't remember. I guess maybe JR, do you remember the last time the Saints had a good defense? Because I can't remember the last time the Saints had a good defense. So that is the one grain of salt. But we are taking a step up in the competition this week. We got Pittsburgh. So as you started to dig in, and I know that you've already started to go and look at some of the tape, look at what the Browns did last week. Like, what are your thoughts on this game and really what Minnesota needs to do? And what do you think will be the big matchup challenges we face as we go against Pittsburgh this coming week?
You know, it was definitely a tall task considering, especially for the Vikings defense. You know, they have very explosive players and two of the best players in the league at their positions in Le'Veon Bell and Antonio Brown and Ben Roethlisberger as well. So, you know, me and you talked about it this morning. I went back and watched the AFC Championship game from last year between the Patriots and the Steelers and just to see what they did to limit both of those guys. So, Antonio Brown ended up with 6 catches for 77 yards, I believe it was. And Le'Veon Bell only had 6 carries for 20 yards or something like that. So very, very limited production on both of those guys' parts that are used to having, you know, huge, huge numbers at the end of the game. So what the Patriots did was they played a bunch of cover one. Basically what that is man-to-man coverage, with the safety, the middle of the field safety, shaded to whatever side Antonio Brown lined up on in the formation. And they kept an extra safety down in the box just to have an extra, you know, guy in the box for Le'Veon Bell. And that's a similar game plan I think the Vikings should have. And another thing that I love that the Patriots did was they maintained gap integrity and gap discipline in the run game. So we all know Le'Veon Bell likes to dance a lot behind the line of scrimmage. They did not over-pursue, and they weren't aggressive in plugging those gaps. So what they did was they just stood there in the gap and let Le'Veon come to them. And once he got to that gap, they tackled him. So they weren't, you know, running through those gaps like their hair was on fire, like you see Eric Kendricks do, or you seen Eric Kendricks did on Monday. They sat back and they just let Le'Veon Bell come to them. And that's what they did to limit Le'Veon Bell. So I think that's a game plan that they should take into consideration going against the Steelers this week. And it's going to be a tall task. And I'm not going to sit here and say it's very easy. You have to pick your poison with one of those guys. And I was very surprised to see the Patriots limit both of those guys the way that they did. And the one thing that's different now from then was Martavis Bryant. He didn't play last year. You know, he was suffering from the suspension. So he's another huge added dimension in that potent offense. And it's going to be a tall task, you know, guarding those two and then having to worry about Le'Veon Bell as well. So the Vikings offense has a very tall task transitioning over to the offensive side of the ball. I think they're going to get a lot of zone coverage because we all know Joe Hayden and Artie Burns are not man-to-man corners. And they're going to watch the film from last week and see what the Saints did to the Vikings receivers and see how much man-to-man coverage that they played. And they understand that their corners are not capable of keeping up with Diggs and Thielen. So I think we're going to see a lot of zone coverage from the Steelers on Sunday.
So you mentioned, you know, New England and the way that they kind of maintain their gaps and just let Le'Veon come to them versus over pursuing and letting him find those cutback lanes. What did the Browns do? Because I mean, you expect that the Patriots are going to have a great game plan and come out and execute and, you know, shut down an opponent like that in a game like that. But it was very surprising to see, you know, the Browns be able to go in there and really shut down who many consider to be the best running back in the NFL. What was their game plan? What did they do? And was there anything we could pull from that game and hope to see the Vikings implement in this game?
Yeah, so what they did was they played more cover two, meaning that they kept two high safeties over the top and two corners in the flat areas. So what they were trying to do was get hands on Antonio Brown really early and, you know, just force him to come off the line of scrimmage or be challenged coming off the line of scrimmage. But the one thing that the Steelers did to adjust from that was they started putting Antonio Brown in the slot, and the Browns just never adjusted to that. And what you saw was he started making a lot of catches over the middle, and he just constantly started killing them over the middle, and the Browns never adjusted to that. So that's why I think the Vikings need to play more of cover one scheme as opposed to cover two scheme.
Well, that is awesome analysis, as always. And perfect timing for you to wrap that up because our guest has joined us and we are very, very happy to have on the Climbing the Pocket podcast, Mr. John Ledyard of FanRag Sports. Does really, really great work. So, John, how you doing? Thanks for joining us tonight, man.
Hey, I'm doing great, guys. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome, man. We will jump right into it. And, you know, we get everyone started with an easy icebreaker type question, I guess. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is John Ledyard? How'd you become a Steelers fan? And how'd you get into this, you know, writing about football game?
Actually, from as young as I can remember, and it really makes no sense because no one in my family, I was the oldest in my family, and neither of my parents were really obsessed with football or anything like that. You know, they'd casually watch it here and there, but I just love the game of football from as long as I can remember. And, you know, I coach it now. I write about it. I talk about it on my podcast. And, you know, it's kind of always what I've done. I went to school for sports broadcasting, sports information, sports journalism. So it's just as long as I can remember, it was the only thing I ever wanted to do. And that's really never changed throughout my life. So for whatever reason, I've just always – I love the sport. I love studying the X's and O's of it and, you know, just about every aspect of it. So it's been a blessing. It's fun. It's a challenging field. But – that's part of the fun of it. I think when you've liked it as long as I have, when you've wanted to do it as long as I've have, you know, you eventually learn these are the things you got to do if you want to make it in this field. And once you can accept that and accept that it's competitive and it's tough, I think you start to enjoy the process and the journey of getting there a lot more.
And that's awesome. And we were just talking there about, you know, the week one matchup the Steelers had with the Browns. And I think for most of us, you know, watching from the outside, that matchup was a lot more competitive, a lot closer than we were really expecting it to be. I guess from your perspective, you know, how did things go versus Cleveland and really how were they able to keep that game as close and as competitive as they were?
Yeah, it was a pretty poor game offensively for Pittsburgh. In some ways it's surprising, in other ways it's not that surprising because Pittsburgh has come out and looked lethargic, and they did in every preseason game on offense. There were issues even when the first team was out there in the third preseason game. They had issues with execution. They had issues with blocking assignments, just simple things. So hard to figure out exactly why that happens, because this is a team that's returning just about everybody who started for several years now. There's not a lot of turnover. There shouldn't be these issues. But Pittsburgh has, for whatever reason, they have difficulty focusing during certain games in the regular season, especially games against worse opponents. It's been going on for years now. And so you never know exactly when it's coming, but you can guarantee there'll be two or three games in the regular season where they play an opponent that's clearly inferior to them, and yet they have a whole heck of a time trying to wrap things up against them. So one thing I did think Cleveland did really well was I thought that their young interior defensive line played really, really well. I know the Steelers didn't try and establish the run enough. I didn't think they diversified their run concepts enough. But given what they were asked to do, given the way they were challenged in that first game, I think Cleveland had to be happy with how their interior defensive line responded to one of the best offensive lines in football. And my guess is that Pittsburgh's offensive line, not for their pass protection, but for their run blocking, got chewed out quite a bit, because they're a group that's much better than what they showed last Sunday. And I think that this week, Munchak will be in their ear about upping their performance, because they were pretty poor against the Browns in terms of establishing the ground game. And part of that's on Haley, because I didn't think he diversified the concepts enough, and I didn't think he worked hard enough to establish the run. But at the same time, this is a veteran offensive line that's played together for a while, and a lot more is and should be expected of them.
Was there anything that you saw schematically from Cleveland that you think other teams might be able to incorporate into a game plan, or do you really just think it was a matter of, you know, Pittsburgh playing a little bit more lethargic and needing to knock some of that rust off?
I thought that Cleveland did some interesting things defensively in their game plan. I don't know whether it's a good idea for other teams to do it, because I think Pittsburgh will adjust to it and really hurt teams. But they played, if they played a single high, he was like 30 yards off the ball. I mean, it was insane. They were just not going to get beat deep, but it left the intermediate middle of the field wide open. And that's where they ended up getting their big play to Antonio Brown. And they're asking their linebackers to carry then in a lot of space. And that's a tough challenge for any linebackers. Their linebackers are fairly athletic. So, you know, it is an interesting idea, I thought, but in the end, I think it did bite them a little bit. I think, but if Pittsburgh, you know, had been a little better prepared for it, I bet that Pittsburgh would have taken more of an advantage of it, because the middle of the field was wide open. And I mean, Jabril Peppers was playing 30 yards off the ball and in his pedal at the snap. So you're giving up a ton of ground to take away the threat of a deep shot down the seams or something of that nature. And even then, I think the Steelers hit it with good timing. So I think it was a matter of Pittsburgh kind of adjusting some of the things that they wanted to do offensively. But you know, and the Cleveland played a lot of too high too, and they just took away the deep portions of the field, which I've seen Pittsburgh, you know, other teams do that a little bit, but Cleveland seemed like they were just determined to do it the whole game, which made it even more interesting why Pittsburgh didn't try to establish the run more than they did. So, like I said, I don't think teams can necessarily be successful doing that moving forward, because there's just no way the Pittsburgh run game is going to be as poor as it was against Cleveland every single week. If teams want to sit that deep on them, they're going to make you pay up front. They're going to gap people out, and they're going to establish the run up front. They've done it before in games. They did it last year against Buffalo, years before, I remember, against Tennessee in a game. So I think the Pittsburgh would respond to it, but it was an interesting strategy that I think threw them a little bit going into the game. I don't know if they expected to see that.
Yeah, and you really brought up the next point that we wanted to get into with you there, is that, you know, with the safeties being so far off the line of scrimmage, what was Cleveland doing that allowed them to effectively slow down Le'Veon Bell?
Yeah, well, Pittsburgh only gave him four carries in the first half, which was a big mistake, I think. And then they came out in the second half, and you thought they'd maybe, you know, try and establish something, and Ben Roethlisberger throws three straight passes, got sacked on second down. So it was interesting. I do think Cleveland did – their linebackers are very active. Jamie Collins and Christian Kirksey, especially Kirksey, really loves to play downhill. If he sees a window, he's firing through it. So I thought the Steelers could have been – they didn't really try and establish much of the perimeter run game at all. That's kind of a go-to for them in the past, typically, you know, outside zone or counter concepts or anything like that. And there were a couple counters with Ramon Foster, and they were their most successful run plays on the day. I think there were two of them. But Bell only had 10 carries in the game, and a couple of those came – very late in the game when Pittsburgh was trying to run clock. So it was obvious at that point. So it really, I do think Cleveland played it well on a couple occasions where they had to defend the run, but it wasn't, I mean, the Steelers really just did, they threw the ball almost the whole game. It was strange, but that's Todd Haley for you. You know, that I love Todd Haley. I think that he's one of the smartest offensive minds in the game, but there are games where he just outthinks himself and he thinks he can, dictate one type of game plan. He just will not abandon it no matter what. And the offense loses balance and he doesn't seem to care. And then, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if this week against Minnesota, they come out and they try and run the ball right at one of the best defensive fronts in the game, and because that's the way you think sometimes, they think we're going to pass. They think we're going to set up these concepts in the passing game. We're going to counter them with the run, even though if that's the strength of their defense, we're going to run at the strength of their defense, And so that's sometimes how Pittsburgh's game plans work. And so you got to be prepared for that. But I do think Cleveland did some good things, but I don't know if it was anything necessarily unique that should have given Pittsburgh issues up front. I mean, I just think Pittsburgh didn't generate enough movement off the ball. And some credit goes to the Browns guys for playing that well. And like I said, some blame should be assigned to the offensive line.
All right. Well, I guess that's enough about week one, because obviously Vikings play the Steelers this week. And I guess from your perspective, what are the keys to this matchup for Pittsburgh? What does Pittsburgh need to establish for them to come out with the victory in this game?
Well, balance on offense is going to be crucial, I think. I don't think you can be one-dimensional against Minnesota. This is one of the best defenses in the game. I think they're one of the best teams in football. There's not a whole lot of holes on the Vikings team. So guys other than Antonio Brown have to be successful, because if Antonio Brown's matched up with Xavier Rhodes, I think Antonio Brown can win any one-on-one matchup in the league, to be honest. But at the same time, you're going to have an advantageous matchup with Martavis Bryant and Trey Waynes or whoever it might be. So I think one of the keys is going to be getting those guys going, because against Cleveland, it was Antonio Brown or it was bust for that offense. I mean, no one else was doing anything. So I think that will be one of the crucial aspects of the game, is getting those other guys, Eli Rogers, Martavis Bryant. He looked like the game was still kind of coming back to him last week. Getting those guys involved, I think, that's going to be huge for Pittsburgh, and getting those guys comfortable with Ben Roethlisberger. And of course, the other thing is that defensive line for Minnesota. I mean, Linval Joseph's one of the best players in the NFL, I think. Doesn't get enough credit, but one of the best players in the NFL. And then Everson Griffin, Danelle Hunter, Brian Robinson is incredibly underrated. I'm a big Jaleel Johnson fan. I think Tom Johnson has worked really, really hard to make his game better and more well-rounded. We even saw him playing some good run defense on Monday night, which was surprising. He's been, typically a heavy pass rush guy for them. And with the Sharif Floyd injury, he's had to step up, and I've been really impressed with what I see from him. He's a heck of a player that doesn't get enough love, and Shamar Stevens. So there's some guys, and this Minnesota, they're deep up front, they're talented up front, they can rush the passer from, and they also have incredibly intense blitz packages. They'll bring their linebackers. Anthony Barr's a versatile piece. You got to know where he is in those third down situations. And so this is where it helps to have an offensive line that's played together for a lot of years. This is where Pittsburgh should have an advantage compared to other teams that Minnesota will face in terms of communication up front, which is a really underrated part of offensive line play. But at the same time, Minnesota is going to prevent one of the more formidable challenges that Pittsburgh will face this season as an offensive line. And so, yes, establishing the run is important, but if the Steelers don't run for 150 yards in this game, I can live with that so much as there's balance up front and these pass rushers from Minnesota aren't able to just tee off on the offensive line and on Ben Roethlisberger.
Yep, and obviously, our front is very deep, very, very good. But the matchup that most Vikings fans have really been looking forward to, really want to talk about, is Xavier Rhodes versus Antonio Brown. So I guess two-part question for you here is, A, if it was you calling the defense for the Vikings, would you shadow, Antonio Brown with Xavier Rhodes? And again, if that's how it worked out, I guess, what would be your expectations for how that matchup goes, Xavier Rhodes versus Antonio Brown?
I would do it. I haven't seen Xavier play in the slot a whole lot. I know he's done it before, second half of last year. I know that he did it. I don't know how successful he's been there compared to being outside. I know it's not as advantageous for him. I think that area of the field is where Antonio Brown could definitely have an advantage compared to maybe other receivers that Xavier Rhodes might face. You're talking about the best route runner in the game, and you're talking about one of the most deceptive route runners in the game. And I think Xavier Rhodes is one heck of a corner. I mean, he's a top five corner in the league. I don't know whether this is the best type of matchup for him. I think that he tends to do a little bit better against the less shiftier types. But then again, the other thing about Xavier Rhodes is if you let him get his hands on you, he can be a very physical, he can take you out of the game physically, which is what he did to Odell Beckham last year. So, there's that aspect of things that I don't think that will bother Antonio Brown. He loves when corners are physical with him. He actually, that's his preference, I think. So I don't think that aspect of his game will bother Antonio Brown as much as it would other smaller receivers. So, Brown kind of thrives on that contact. He actually plays better versus those kind of corners, I think, than he does against any other type. So I think it's an advantageous matchup for Brown in some ways. I mean, as advantageous as it can be to go against a top five corner in the league. I expect Rhodes to shadow him, especially with the issues the Vikings have had at the other corner positions and the fact that Pittsburgh hasn't, as of right now, why not make them go to Martavis Bryant, who looked uncomfortable last week, and, you know, Eli Rogers in the slot, or the rookie Juju Smith-Schuster. You know, I think there's tons of talent there for Pittsburgh and all three of those guys. But sure, I mean, you take away Antonio Brown. He was all their offense last week. So, you know, take away Antonio Brown and see if the rest of the guys what they can do, make the other guys beat you. And I think that's how Minnesota will play it. And I expect Brown to win his fair share of matchups with Xavier Rhodes, but at the same time, if that's your only offense, I just don't know if you can be consistently successful like they were last week.
And JR, I wanted you to hop in here because before John came on, you were kind of talking through that Patriots game and the game plan that they used to slow down the Steelers. So I wanted you to kind of walk John through your thoughts on that and see, I guess, if he agrees with your take on kind of how that was implemented and if Minnesota could be successful doing that in this week's matchup.
Yeah, first off, John, it's JR. Great to finally meet you, buddy, and thanks for coming on so much.
Hey, absolutely, man. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you asking.
No problem. So basically what I said was I'm doing a little film review for a website called Vikings Territory, just outlining a game plan that Mike Zimmer can put together to slow down Pittsburgh's potent offense. And I went back and looked at the AFC Championship game from last year between the Steelers and the Patriots. And basically what they did was they played a ton of cover one or man-to-man coverage. And they shaded the free safety to whatever side Antonio Brown was on. So I think that's a big game plan that Mike Zimmer should incorporate, having Harrison Smith as the one high safety and then having Xavier Rhodes shadow Antonio Brown, as well as our new acquired corner in Tremaine Brock, you know, shadowing Martavis Bryant. So basically what Mike Zimmer should do is force Eli Rogers to make plays, no matter if he – you know, catches for 200 yards. I'm fine with that. Force Eli Rogers to make plays. So what do you think about that game plan?
Yeah, it's an interesting strategy. Teams have employed it before. Cleveland's actually employed it in years past, and other teams in the AFC North that face Antonio Brown a lot, you know, bracket him on the inside, basically force him to the outside and man coverage and take away some of his route tree. He's found a way to beat it in the past. But, I mean, you're talking Xavier Rhodes and Harrison Smith. First of all, that's a great duo, obviously, to be committing to one guy. But at the same time, other guys will have to win matchups if that's what Minnesota tries to do. And that's really what it comes down to, right? I mean, if you're going to commit that type of attention to Antonio Brown, which honestly other teams have done because it's needed at that point. And last year, teams could do it a little more easily because there was no Martavis Bryant. And Eli Rogers is good, but again, he's a pure slot. You can't move him around. You know where he's going to be. It's easier to take him out of the game. There was no big threat opposite them. So, you know, I think this year it will be tougher if Martavis Bryant gets back to form because Juju Smith-Schuster is pretty polished. I think he's going to be able to contribute pretty decently heavily as the year moves on, I think. And I think you're going to start to see some stuff out of him. It is week two, though, so how quickly is he going to be able to do that? That's going to be a big question mark. But I wouldn't be surprised if I saw Minnesota try and do that. I know Pittsburgh has done some different things with Antonio Brown, stacked the receivers, you know, played him off the ball so he gets a clean release, done some things like that to try and get him quick looks and get the ball in his hands so he can make stuff happen after the catch. They're completely comfortable and they faced those situations before. So it won't be anything new to them if it's employed. But, yeah, other guys are definitely going to have to step up and make plays if the Minnesota is going to commit the best two guys in their secondary to Antonio Brown.
Good. And I just wanted to transition to the other side of the ball as well. We know you guys, you know, signed Joe Hayden. You have Artie Burns as well, who you guys invested some draft capital in. And what's your thoughts on just slowing down Stephon Diggs and Adam Thielen, who I think are two very underrated wide receivers?
Yeah, they are. They're really good. And they prevent a formidable challenge because they have both have versatility, play inside out. They can both run the full route tree and be threatening in the full route tree, to be honest. And so that presents a challenge because Joe Hayden is not the burner that he once – well, he was never a burner, I should say, but he doesn't have the speed that he once did. He is susceptible vertically. As much as I like him playing, you know, top down on the ball, and I like him in zone coverage and his instincts and breaking on the ball, he's definitely a little bit susceptible to getting beat over the top. And Artie Burns has shown consistently in the time that he's played, you know, a little year plus now, that he is also susceptible to getting beat vertically. You know, I can think of a couple games that come to mind right away where he's been, you know, allowed separation over the top, and it's either given up a big play or Mike Mitchell's had to come over from center field and save his butt. So there are definitely areas of the field there outside the numbers, one-on-one against those guys, whether it's cover three or press man, whatever it might be, the Vikings can win matchups there in that area of the field. I think Pittsburgh, for the most part, does a decent job of taking away the middle of the field. Mike Mitchell's one of the better safeties in the league. He doesn't get enough credit. But outside the numbers in the deep vertical areas of the game, I think Pittsburgh is susceptible, not only just based on skill, but also double moves or route combinations that could flood zones and things like that. I think you can get Artie Burns' eyes elsewhere and get him off his marks as a corner. And I think that Minnesota, I expect to see an attack and do some of those things. He wasn't really challenged too much against Cleveland, and I expect Minnesota to offer much more of a challenge. And you mentioned, you know, Diggs and Thielen, and those are, you know, two really good playmakers. If the Vikings can have a third guy step up with those guys, I think that's going to be a really tough wide receiver unit to stop.
Well, that's an awesome segue there, because you mentioned that third guy. I guess, what are your thoughts on Laquon Treadwell? Because that stirs up some very, very passionate debate on Vikings Twitter. So, you know, you do a lot of great work in that aspect of things. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on Treadwell and him being that guy to step up? Or do you think it's more likely that comes from somebody else in the receiver pool, like a Michael Floyd when he comes back from his suspension, or somebody else on down the line?
I don't know, man. It's got to be Treadwell, I feel like. But, yeah, he hasn't done it yet. So, I mean, it's a little bit disappointing. You know, Treadwell was my wide receiver two. Michael Thomas was my wide receiver one. But I still like Treadwell. He's still a top 15, top 20 guy on my board. And, man, I don't get it. I don't know if it's the work or smarts thing or what exactly it is. I know the Vikings are rough on the rookies, but, you know, this is the second year now. You got to prove yourself, man. Like, you know, no more excuses. You know, physically, I think he has a skill set that would fit perfectly with what they have. You know, it'd be a great complementary piece on the outside, you know, a true X receiver, you know, that's going to win jump balls and, you know, win those tight battles in the air, be a red zone threat. You know, he was all those things in college. You know, even if he can't run the full route tree, great, you know, use what routes he can run and get him, you know, get him out there running those routes. I mean, so that part's confusing for me. I don't know, you know, the as much of the situation as some guys that would cover them, you know, closely and see the practices and know what his temperament's like there and how many mistakes he makes there. You know, that would help me, but it's hard because we didn't really see him on the field that much last year. So we don't really know we just know, you know, hearsay what the issues might be. Obviously he's not proven himself, but, or at least I only know that. So I think he's got to be the guy. You know, when Floyd comes back, I think that he will contribute. You know, I think that, you know, he's an NFL ready guy. I think he's a good receiver. Like, there's no, you know, Floyd, his issues came off the field, and that's what's kind of plagued him recently. You know, I don't think there's much question that when he's focused and in shape and his game's on point, there's nothing else going on. You know, he's a good receiver. So I think he'll help. Maybe it's that, but I don't know. They invested a lot in Laquon Treadwell to not try and give this some run. So I would love to see him become more of a featured aspect. But again, he's got to prove that, because he could be the piece that they're missing, honestly, that, you know, the other piece to complement and round out that offense in the red area, especially. But that hasn't happened yet. So, you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see how his second year progresses.
And then the next question, which is also one of those things that it gets people pretty worked up when it's discussed on Twitter and sometimes on this podcast. What are your thoughts on Sam Bradford?
Sam Bradford changed my opinion of him a little bit the other night. No, I shouldn't say changed, but you know, I think he has the potential to change it. I honestly think that Sam Bradford, I've always thought he's a pretty good quarterback, but just way too hesitant to test deep windows, to test tight windows, you know, to throw into any type of tight window or any type of, you know, trust his receivers to make a play. And especially in the vertical portions of the field, you know, just too conservative in the past for my liking. And man, he didn't play like that on Monday night. So I don't know whether, you know, it's faith in his receivers and getting a little more comfortable. And, you know, typically a guy that I thought in the past was a little skittish under pressure looked great under pressure the other night. So yeah, last night challenged my thinking of him a little bit, and now we'll see how, you know, it's all about, everything's about doing it consistently, you know, but you know, the top five quarterback talk that I've heard in some circles is a little bit much for me, but you know, I think he's a good starter. It's easy to see why he's a guy that teams would give up assets for, right? I mean, this league is hurting for quarterbacks immensely, and he's clearly better than most of the quarterbacks in the league, or at least, you know, he's not a bottom half of the league quarterback. So this is a guy you can absolutely win with if you've got a great team around him, and the Vikings are building that. They have a much better team than I think people realized coming into the season. I didn't feel like they got any real hype at all, and to me, I think they're going to be right there in the race for the NFC North title. I think they're going to be one of the best teams that the Steelers play all season. I think Bradford could take – it's always possible for me that Bradford could take his game to another level because it's never been a talent issue. I would be surprised if at this point in his career he does that consistently for a full season and really does – you know, you can see that much growth in him at this point. It would be surprising. It would probably be a little bit abnormal to see that kind of a leap for a quarterback at this stage. But the way he played the other night, if he can do that consistently for 16 games, I'll be singing a different tune at the end of the season.
Well, that's awesome. I guess, JR, did you have any other questions you wanted to jump into?
Yeah, just one last one, and, you know, it doesn't have to be a long answer. I love you guys' nose tackle, who's very underrated, and Javon Hargrave. Mm-hmm. I think he's a phenomenal player. Just his thoughts on the matchup with Pat Elflein, who's a guy you and me both were really high on pre-draft.
Yeah. Yeah, I love Elflein. I think he's going to get his lunch eaten this week, though. I'm not going to lie. I mean, that's a tough matchup. Hargrave is such an interesting player because if you stand next to him at practice, you would just never think that he plays in the NFL. I mean, and then if you told me he played nose tackle in the NFL, it's hard to fathom because there are not many guys built like him, you know, that play in the league and especially play that position. And he has been probably, you know, you could definitely say, and I think it would be true, that he's been the best rookie from that class. You know, and one of their better ones to come along here in a while. I mean, he's been fantastic. And not only as a run blocker or as a run stuffer, but also as a pass rusher. I mean, he's shown off a variety of moves. He's shown off swims. He uses bull rushes. You know, he gets off blocks. You know, he's impossible to reach in zone concepts. He's the real deal. He's the all-around real deal, and he can play a variety of different techniques as well. My biggest issue is he played 25 snaps last game, and Tyson Alualu, who has played well in Pittsburgh, played 54 snaps when Stephon Tuitt went down on, like, the third play of the game. You know, you have to play Javon Hargrave more. You have to, especially if Tuitt's probably going to be out this week with an injury, with a bicep injury. So you're going to be in nickel sub packages, like, 75% of the time. You've got to have Hargrave and Hayward out there more than you have Hayward and Tuitt or Hayward and Alualu out there. You know, it's just he is a much better all-around player in every way and has the same versatility that Alualu does to play multiple spots in the defensive line. So I thought that was a big error from the last game. Hargrave played and was dominant when he was on the field for those 25 snaps. I mean, he was almost unblockable, but yet kept getting pulled and Alualu kept going in. And Alualu played well, but you're talking about a guy who is on a different level with his hands and explosive abilities in Javon Hargrave than where Alualu's at. So if Tuitt is out, I do hope and expect to see more Javon Hargrave in this game than we've probably ever seen in a game for him before in Pittsburgh.
Well, that's awesome. Last question is the opportunity for you to plug anything that you have going on. I guess what upcoming projects? Where can we read your work? Anything that we need to be made aware of that our listeners should go check out?
Yeah, well, most of your listeners are probably Vikings fans, so I don't know if they don't want to check out Locked On Steelers. That's my podcast on the Steelers that occurs 3 days a week. But you can check out Locked On NFL Draft if there's any draft fans out there that you guys are interested in what, you know, Minnesota might be thinking. You can check it out now or check it out when we get close to the draft, whatever, you know. But Trevor Sikkema, my co-host, and I, we cover the NFL draft 5 days a week. We have a podcast called Locked On NFL Draft. It's over at iTunes and Audio Boom. You guys can check that out. And then, of course, you can follow my written work, and I've written about a couple of Vikings too. I'm a huge – I like a lot of the guys on their team, but, you know, I've written a lot about Everson Griffen, Danelle Hunter, and Brian Robeson, and how I think they're one of the best, you know, three edge-rushing, you know, trio in the NFL. They're one of the best there. Read a lot of that stuff over at fanragsports.com. And then if you want to check out more of my draft work, you can do that over at ndtscouting.com. But yeah, really that's it. Follow me on Twitter at LedyardNFLDraft if you're interested in more.
Well, that's awesome, man. Thank you very, very much for coming on. And listeners should definitely check it out this week, at least. I mean, you seem like you have a lot of nice things to say about the Vikings. So, Ben, you know, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it. Ton of knowledge dropped on us this evening. So, thank you, man, and have a good night.
Hey, thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Oh, man. Well, that was an awesome segment with John Ledyard. Definitely follow him on Twitter and check out his stuff. JR, now that we got all of that information, inside information about the Steelers, what's your bold prediction for this game?
I do not have a good feeling at all about this game. I just see Antonio Brown having a big day. And I just think the Vikings defense will be in over their head on this game. I have a Steelers 31. I have a Vikings 17.
Wow. See, my bold prediction in this game is that Stephon Diggs will outgain Antonio Brown and Dalvin Cook will outgain Le'Veon Bell. And I have the Vikings winning 28-24.
Ooh, that's bold.
28-24. So what you got going on, man? What you working on? I know you mentioned that you're working on that game preview for Vikings territory. Anything else we need to be on the lookout for? Any more Twitter moments that will be coming our way in the not too distant future?
Yeah, so the Twitter moments thing is something that I'll be doing after every single game, just so it's a better way for fans to interact and just see what I see. And just breaking down clips from each and every game. And it's something I really enjoy. And even though I overload everybody's timeline, I apologize for that. Twitter moments is something that's very good and very helpful for, I think, fans can better understand the game and just break down certain concepts and aspects that I'm seeing throughout the game.
And if they want to, and if you don't want JR overloading your timeline and you want to mute him until he's finished, you can catch the full recap of his Twitter moments on climbingthepocket.com when he's all done as well.
Absolutely.
So we got the Twitter recap. We got the game preview. How are things going with the draft spreadsheet, man?
It's going good. I'm actually up to 102 prospects. The goal is to get up to 200 by the week of the draft in April and release it to the masses.
So one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, kind of as you're going through and you're putting them in order, how much movement or how much do you guys move after you get them in the spreadsheet? Like, how tough is it for a guy that maybe you fall in love with early in the process and, man, this is my number one guy? Like, how tough is it for someone to kind of leapfrog those guys that you fall in love with early in the process?
Well, all the grades are based off what I saw in the spring up until the point that I studied them. So grades they pretty much change and fluctuate throughout the process. So like a guy for Connor Williams, for example, the tackle from Texas, he's kind of gotten off to a rough start this year. So I haven't actually went back and watched his games in depth, but once I do go back, I'll go back and adjust some things that I see. And that's why I type up the scouting reports as well, because it helps me remember some of the things that I saw from the spring, whether it was good and bad. And I can go in and alter some stuff that I saw or something from his grade, whether it's run blocking, pass blocking, or just his technique, whether it got better or it got worse. And another great example is Mike McGlinchey, the Notre Dame offensive tackle, who's really, really struggling so far this year. So there's some things I have to go back and alter in his grade as well.
Oh, wow. So all the guys you have in the spreadsheet now, you already have scouting reports for them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Man, my man doing work. Well, yeah, can't wait for all of that to make its way into the wild. Sounds like you are really grinding it out here nonstop. It's a good thing that you don't sleep, or there's no way that you'd ever be able to get all this stuff done. But yeah, I think that's pretty much what we got for today. Great show, great guest. And you know, next time we'll be back post-game, wrap things up with the full crew, hopefully. My name is Jason Brown. Thank you for listening here with the QB1 JR. Y'all have a good night.